Welcome to The Impossible Network, the podcast about everyday people living extraordinary lives. Each week, we explore how their upbringing affected them, how creativity fueled them, and how serendipity guided them.
The Iconic Advantage strategy that we created was very, very simple. It's made up of three things. So there's noticing power, that's being different for a meaningful reason. There's staying power, and that's about understanding what it is that is central to your product or your brand or whatever you're innovating on, and making sure that you know what cannot change and also what can change, what the opportunities are. So there's some stuff that you can't mess with. And then the third thing is scaling power. And scaling power is about making sure as many eyeballs see it, to make sure that your audience knows it's there, is very visible to them.
Dave Burrs describes himself as an author, public speaker, consultant, filmmaker, chap. I know him as one of the most interesting creative thinkers on idea development, innovation, and why organizations and educational institutions must embrace creativity to prepare for our AI-powered future. With an award-winning career as a digital creative director in some of London's top ad agencies behind him, Dave has recently turned his attention to an exploration of the creative mind. Now three books to his name and a methodology called Right Thinking, Dave is applying his creative thinking framework along with tools and resources to help organizations direct their mental and creative effort more effectively. On the show, we have a wide-ranging discussion on all aspects of creativity, innovation and disruption, including the barriers, the processes, the physiology and the neuroscience of idea development. I hope you enjoy the thinking of Dave Burrs.
Well, thanks for being on the show, Dave. Great to see you here in New York. It's been a while.
It's always good to be here. Yes, thank you. Thanks for asking me on.
Yeah, well, and we are in unusual surroundings. We were supposed to be in the studio at Acast, which is actually three floors above us. We're two floors down at the offices of Courtney Renicky, another guest on the Impossible Network, who's kindly lent us one of her offices. So we've got some interesting sort of mix up of iPhones, cushions, to muffle some of the, sort of the sound of the office. But I think we'll get by. So, Dave, you and I sort of go back to, I think, 2007, where we first met in Cannes.
Yeah.
At the Ad Festival in those good old days.
Indeed.
And it's been a while. I think one thing that we certainly share is our view that creativity isn't a domain, that's not really reserved for the few, that it's a capacity that's in all of us, albeit it's pretty suppressed, confined and crushed in many people by either their personal, educational or the corporate attitudes and the conventions and norms that we all face. What's your sort of view on creativity at the moment, given you've been really prolific over the last few years as a writer, as a consultant, as in your speaking gigs, talking about creativity and innovation? You must have interesting perspective on the state of the word, the term, and the concept in itself.
Yeah, it's been evolving over the last few years, because I would have thought when I was creative director of ad agencies, I would have thought that I would have known what creativity was. And now I look back and I think I really didn't have much of a clue at all. I did a study a couple of years ago to see what other people thought creativity was. So I put up an online survey and it just said, what is creativity? I said, don't Google it, don't consult a dictionary, just type your answer in here. And I got hundreds of responses. It was amazing how many responses I got. And it was also amazing how there was nothing cohesive. There was nothing that brought them together apart from the misunderstandings, the myths that people believed. And you could split it into categories. So some people believed that creativity was a special talent reserved for the few. Mm-hmm. Some people thought it was a process, and that's probably a bit closer to the truth. Some people thought it was a load of old nonsense because they'd probably had to endure terrible brainstorms and all the rest. And it really showed me that if we've got a fundamental misunderstanding of what creativity is as a culture within our companies, within our nations, then we can't use it properly if we don't understand what it is. And that set me in a path over the last couple of years of actually trying to work out what actually is creativity. And I've tried to simplify it and simplify it and simplify it until I've kind of got to this place that it's not this, that's creative and that's not creative. It's not a binary thing. It's a sliding scale. And you measure the sliding scale with obviousness. So if that's obvious, it's not creative. If something's non-obvious, then it's something that we would describe as creative. And it takes work to get to this non-obvious stuff. And that's the one thing that people tend to not know how to do that. And that's what I've been working with organizations with, is actually how do you get to these non-obvious and valuable areas?
Isn't that the domain, just to go back to our days in Adland, but isn't that the domain and the skill set of a good creative director, is pushing people away from the obvious to the non-obvious? And it's something that they've developed skills in, and that being obviously their primary domain.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much, having done that for many years, yeah, very much was trying to push people into new territories. But there was also the idea of value, because it's not just about being new and non-obvious, it's about being valuable. And depending on what the problem you're trying to solve, that idea of value can change. Mm-hmm. So it could be that it gives you monetary value. It could be that the value you get is extra attention from people. It could be that the value that you get is in even just solving a process, coming up with a different way of doing things within a company, that a different way of getting people to fill in spreadsheets, you know, something quite dull. If that is the value, if it nudges the needle on whatever metric you're measuring it on, then it's something that we'd consider to be valuable. But it's these two things, is both non-obvious and valuable. If we can imagine that there's a sort of quadrant, mm-hmm. then that's the quadrant we want to be in. If we've got a matrix there, the quadrant we want to be in is valuable and non-obvious.
And wouldn't that play into the hands of the innovation consultant and say that's what innovation, really, innovation practices try and do?
Yeah, absolutely. But also this idea of creativity, what we're finding is that for the people who are doing innovation in companies, the creativity doesn't necessarily have to come from them, particularly, I mean, when innovation very often isn't defined within a company as to what it is, which creates problems. But for some people, it's purely digital transformation. It's what they see innovation being. Then very often that's about getting a platform where somebody else has put the creative thinking in and all the hard thinking to be able to get a great platform, and then you implement that. So sometimes the creative thinking doesn't have to be created where you are for it to be valuable to the company. And a lot of the time, people within the world of innovation have fallen for this myth of disruption. And this idea of trying to do things different, to try and be the next Airbnb of insurance. You know, and it's not the way forward. It's not the way it works. Because these big organizations are not designed to embrace that kind of thinking, for one. And the other thing is, when you disrupt, you disrupt everyone in your company. You disrupt all the go-betweens that you have. You disrupt your suppliers. You disrupt your customers. Now, that means that you're in a very high-risk, high-cost area if you're doing that. And that's not the way to do successful innovation.
But wouldn't Clayton Christensen, he argue that you either have to disrupt or be at risk of being disrupted? So it's a choice that individuals, or a choice that businesses have, that they have to do something. But I know, I mean, that's a question back at you, but also I'd just add to that. I did note that you, in your last book, I think it was, The Innovation Advantage, where you talk about the importance of the business looking at their core business as a way to leverage advantage and competitive differentiation, rather than necessarily look for disruption in some sort of new category or to reinvent their business. So maybe you'd like to reflect on those two elements.
Absolutely. Iconic Advantage, the book.
Iconic Advantage.
I co-wrote that with a guy called Sun Yu, and he used to be head of innovation for VF Corp, Vanity Fair Corporation. So that was Timberland, Vans, The North Face, Napapijri, great big brands. And his innovation generated a lot of revenue, which is really unusual for innovation to do that. And the approach that we kind of crystallized in the book was about, a lot of people with innovation are trying to innovate the new, but actually the successful long-term innovative companies innovate the old. And their innovation efforts are used to grow their brand and cement their brand within their target audience. So the idea of being iconic is about being the first brand or the first product your audience thinks of when they think of your category. That's what makes you iconic. So it's not necessarily about trying to be super sexy or incredibly well designed, because you can be iconic as an insurance company. You can be iconic as a plumber if it's you're the first one that your audience thinks of when they think of your category. But to get back to the disruption thing with Clayton Christensen, and he talked about, I mean, he really was the guy who coined this in about 96. And I think that people have taken his stuff out of context, because a disruptive technology is something you can only describe in retrospect and say that that disrupted. You can't say that something you're doing is going to disrupt, because you just don't know. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the stuff that we would say is disruptive, when I ask people what they think the most disruptive companies are, they'll say things like Airbnb, they'll say Tesla, they'll say Uber, you know, and it's all Spotify, and they come up with all these sort of same kind of things that they say they've changed industries, they're disruptive. None of them, not one of them, was the first to market for what they did. Does that make them disruptive? They disrupted. But the problem is, when companies are trying to go out there into a totally new area that doesn't have overlap with what they do very often, there's just, what you're saying to people is, you need to unlearn this and you need to relearn this. That's a highly risky strategy. And I think that people have misunderstood the idea of disruption, and they're trying to be disruptive in the wrong way, because they think it means that you have to do something completely new, completely different. But actually, the companies that we describe as disruptive are actually, they're not first to market, and they have just got something that makes them slightly better from what's out there.
Could you give an example? You mentioned the VF company, corporation. Could you give some tangible examples of that at play and what they did?
Well, Soon would really be the one who would be best to talk about this, and maybe he'd be actually be a good guest. But we can talk about
Companies that have sort of embraced what you're talking about in the book. I keep calling it the innovation advantage, the
iconic advantage. A good example is Nike, I guess. You know, they when it came to Nike Air, what happened is there's a guy called M. Frank Rudy. He was a NASA engineer. And he had been working on the Apollo space missions on the helmets. So he created these things that was amazing. It was air pocket technology that kept it light, it gave it rigidity, and it also had thermodynamic properties as well, to keep the heat in and all the rest. And when he left NASA, he realized that this technology they'd created at NASA was pretty powerful. And as somebody who was interested in running, he thought, well, you know, if this stuff, it means that you're running on air. If you're able to put this into your footwear, because training shoes, as somebody who does a lot of running, you'll know that they lose like 40 to 50% of their bounce throughout their life.
Yeah.
So they become less cushioning over the more you use them, and they lose it very quickly as well. But when you've got an air pocket, it never loses bounce. So he took it around all the shoe companies. The shoe companies were not interested. And he went to this new startup, really, Nike. They'd been running for a few years, and they'd mainly been importing Onitsuka Tigers from Japan. And they were thinking about doing their own shoes and starting to look at this. And when he came to them with the technology, you know, they were young, they didn't have that much to lose, and they went, yeah, let's go for it. Now, the first shoe that they put the technology into was the Tailwind. And the Tailwind
was back in, I think, 1986, 87, I seem to remember.
It was about 1980, 1979, 1980, something like that. Now, the Tailwind didn't sell well.
Yeah.
Because what happens, you know, they say that advertising is the tax you pay in a bad product. They had to advertise the fact that there was air in there because you couldn't see it. Mm. So it didn't sell well because people couldn't see it. And then out came the Air Max 1. What was that? 84, 85, something like that?
No, I think it was 86, because that's when you actually saw the actual sort of pocket itself. And that was a big innovation.
Do you remember seeing the first time?
Yeah, picking it up and going, wow.
I know, and you look through it and you prod it and you sniff it and you're like, oh, wow, squeeze it. And that, it made it look different from every other shoe on the shelf. But it also communicated the benefit. And what they've done since then is it's all been about what we call visible air. And they have expanded from it being this little area that was maybe smaller than the palm of your hand to now it's the whole shoe. And my wife's got a pair that just the whole underside that she got a couple of months ago, it is just air. And it's incredible that they have people understood air, and they have just moved it. Like, if I'm doing things with my hands here, which is very bad for a podcast. So if you can imagine that you've got a Venn diagram circle, that's people's understanding of what Nike Air is, visible air. And each year they have just moved it slightly. So the circle overlaps. Most of the way overlaps. It just eases out ever so slightly. And each year they keep overlapping it. And that means that when you do that, you can take people on a journey, but there always has to be more familiarity than unfamiliarity on that journey. And you just look at Apple devices, and that's what they've done. So they do, just like Nike, you've got one breakthrough, you've got your iPhone. And again, Apple weren't the inventors of that. They're very good at buying technology. And it really came from, Palm Pilot kind of came out of Apple, and then they were interested in this. They'd done the Newton.
Well, the Newton failure, obviously one of the spectacular failures of Jobs era.
And then they bought the company that did the iPod. So they then took that and developed it, made it something beautiful. And then as that kept developing, then they put the phone technology in and made the full screen device. And they cracked it. It's fantastic. But you compare the first iPhone, I've got one in a cupboard at home, to what I've got now, it's not a huge difference. I mean, it doesn't look that different. I mean, you've got the iPhone X that doesn't have the button, but for mine, I've still got the button on it. And you can see that it's just evolved gradually over the years, but there's still the same elements that we're familiar with throughout.
So how do you find this concept? How is it embraced when you go into companies and talk about this importance of an iconic advantage? When they're expecting you to come in there and guide them on sort of how to sort of push their creativity, sort of create innovation, sort of instill disruption in the workforce, and then you tell them, actually, let's look at where your company is today and...
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things there.
It's almost like an iterative innovation rather than a large leap forward or term disruption. I know you'd certain disdain for.
But we're disrupting the idea of disruption. Yeah. I know, it becomes ironic at that point. There's a couple of things. One's iconic advantage. The companies we're speaking to about it are really liking this as a strategy, because a lot of them, when it comes to innovation, they've never really quite defined what they mean by innovation or what innovation involves. Which means that when you start up an innovation department and it's not defined, these guys want to do the sexy stuff. So they want to do the stuff that's disruptive. They want to be heading down to Austin every year to do the South by Southwest and find everything. Because, you know, and yes, that is good stuff. But unless you have an understanding of how you're focusing your innovation and what you're planning to get out of it and how you want to use it to grow your business and to grow, develop your product and to make your product, getting it into the hearts of your consumer in a more robust way. If you don't have that as your core, then you're just innovating in different directions, doing lots of stuff. So it's one of the first things I do when I'm speaking to companies about innovation is actually sit down with them and go, right, what is your innovation strategy? And I'll tell you that most of the time they say, what do you mean? We're doing innovation. It's just like, no, why are you doing innovation? What's the remit of innovation? What are you hoping to get out of your innovation? How are you measuring your innovation? If you don't have that stuff in place, then, you know, you're just going off in all sorts of directions. But yeah, the iconic advantage strategy that we created was very, very simple. It's made up of three things. So there's noticing power. That's being different for a meaningful reason. There's staying power. And that's about understanding what it is that is central to your product or your brand or whatever you're innovating on. And making sure that you know what cannot change and also what can change, what the opportunities are. So there's some stuff that you can't mess with. And then the third thing is scaling power. And scaling power is about making sure as many eyeballs see it, to make sure that your audience knows it's there, is very visible to them. And you can do that through
good old ad agency.
Yeah, advertising, but also distribution.
So the staying power, scaling power, and the first thing was
noticing power.
Noticing power, right.
Yeah, okay. Noticing power, staying power, and scaling power. And it's all in the book. It's very... In fact, I think maybe in the website as well.
And how has that moved on with the new book? Well, are you taking that in a different direction?
Yeah, well, my new book isn't... there's parts that will nudge into what the Iconic Advantage strategy was. But this new book is called How to Get to Great Ideas. And it's kind of, again, I would split this into four parts. The first part of the book is getting rid of a lot of the myths and bullshit that surrounds creativity and innovation, and trying to then explain using science a lot of the time. I use neuroscience, evolutionary psychology, social psychology to explain the importance of creativity and what creativity actually is. The second part explains how a process that can solve any problem, pretty much. And it's something I've been developing for a few years now, and it's called Right Thinking. And Right, R-I-G-H-T, stands for research, insight, generate ideas, hone ideas, test ideas. And I've done this for people who want marketing ideas. I worked with the oil industry on engineering ideas, actually how to cap oil wells. We used it for that, and we've used it for processes as well as products. So I'm finding that this system is working for everything. So I explain.
It's going back to what you earlier said, as if creativity is a process,
Very much,
and a black box.
A lot of people from our old industry of advertising hate the idea that creativity is a process. Mm-hmm. But it actually is, and if you follow the process properly, that's how you get to the best solutions. So then the third section is about how individuals can have the best ideas, and that's not about hacks and brainstorm techniques. It's actually about habits, the fact that you need to feed your brain with good information. And then the last section is on how organizations can help ideas flourish, because most organizations are actually set up to murder ideas. And it's to show them how to get around it, to encourage ideas from their staff.
But isn't that sort of the principle, the irony of businesses that have got their innovation departments, that it says it's the domain, going back to the almost like the creative department, it's the domain of one sort of group of people.
Yeah.
When actually you're trying to foster a culture of creativity and innovation in everyone, and to allow them to move forward without fear, to enable risk taking, and all the things that we know are actually sort of make people feel happier, more fulfilled, and more driven, and more motivated at work. And it might be as simple as that.
You're absolutely right. I think that most companies are toxic to to ideas, and the ghettoization of creativity, I think, is really harmful. I think that it's one of the reasons that the advertising industry isn't as healthy as it was, because of the ghettoization of creativity. I think that if you manage it properly, then you should be tapping into minds that come at it from different perspectives, because when you've got a creative department, they are actually coming at it from the same perspective. And the mind is just a processor. And I've got to say, I used to get frustrated with some of my creative departments, because I felt they weren't feeding their mind. So we're both tech guys, so understanding the way that programmers would look at stuff, you've got garbage in, garbage out, is what they say.
Yep.
And the brain is just a processor. So if you want to affect your output and to get the best creative output, it's not getting a more powerful processor, it's actually having better input. So the way that you can come up, however powerful you think your brain is, the way that you can come up with ideas that no one else can come up with is by spotting things that no one else has seen. Mm-hmm. Because if you've got different input to everyone else, you can have different output to everyone else. But then the thing comes from what you're talking about is the idea of fear.
Well, that's a role of leadership, surely, within the companies that you must speak to, because if the leaders aren't instilling the environment and the attitude for their staff to approach things with the way you're describing, then they're not sort of executing the role as a leader as effectively as they should be.
And stats are proving that. I mean, last year, McKinsey did a study, and it said that it was for CEOs, and they asked hundreds of CEOs, how satisfied are you with your innovation efforts? And 6% of the CEOs said they were satisfied with their innovation. That is horrendous. 94% of CEOs do not say they're satisfied with their innovation efforts. Something has gone wrong. And I believe it's that most companies don't understand how to get ideas, how to nurture ideas, and how to take them through to execution. And they may be getting the ideas from their innovation people, but they're not getting out there. They're not making it intact to the end of the process, because very often the process is interminable, with so many meetings they have to have, so many people having their input, that if you manage that wrong, you know, the idea gets damaged and dies on the way. So there's lots of little things like that. I'm very interested in how do companies get better ideas and actually make them happen.
Maybe the issue is that although today every business has to become a technology company in some description, I can remember I was talking to someone in the last week just describing how every company they encounter are looking at how they're taking themselves and applying artificial intelligence, machine learning, etc., to help them transform and going through this digital transformation. But the reality is they're maybe taking their eye away from the sort of the softer side of creativity, or holding them back from either taking the chances, the risks that they need to take to help give them that differentiation and that competitive advantage over their competitors. And maybe it's just an inherent sort of fear of failure that exists there. Is this something that you're sort of encountering with some of the conversations you have on your consulting jobs?
Yeah, I was doing a talk to a conference of the world's mayors a few months ago. It was a peculiar audience to have. And I was explaining to them how every organization is a hierarchy. And each layer of a hierarchy is a layer of fear. So people are second-guessing the people above them because they don't want to look stupid if they're going to present an idea on, oh, that doesn't work because of this. So they make the idea smaller, each layer of fear. And they act like lawyers. And this is nothing against lawyers, but how does a lawyer measure their value? You know, if you give a lawyer a contract and the lawyer just looks at the contract and goes, yeah, it looks all right, go for it. You're going to feel as if you've not got the value out of the lawyer. The lawyer shows their value by going, well, I think there's a problem here. We need to insert a clause. I think we need to reword this. You know, they're going to spot problems. That's a lawyer's job. And every single layer of management in a hierarchy acts like lawyers. And they shouldn't. It's not what they should be doing. Because lawyers are focused on spotting problems, but the people who are great at encouraging ideas spot opportunities. Opportunities are the opposite of problems. And in organizations, you cannot expect an idea to travel through those layers of hierarchy to the decision maker at the top and remain intact and as powerful as they can be. Yet that's what most companies do. They believe that's the way it works. So I show companies how there's different ways of doing that. And one of the best companies at this who've been doing this since the 1950s is Toyota. So what happens is that anyone, wherever you are, if you're a sweeper in the factory, you can give your ideas. And in fact, it's in your contract. You're expected to come up with ideas to keep improving the company. It's in your contract. And anyone can come up with the idea, and they submit their idea into a suggestion box. And then their peers look at that idea. So every now and then, they'll get the ideas out, and they'll look at them and go, yep, that's great. Something in that, but maybe we need to develop it. That's terrible. That's great. And the best ideas are then passed from that peer group of sweepers in the factory straight up to the decision makers. Does not pass through any of the layers. Goes straight to the decision makers at the top, and they go yes or no. Now, they avoid the hierarchy. They've known this for nearly 70 years, and they get 20 ideas per individual per year. Now, that is extraordinary. When you put that across the whole organization, that they're getting more than one idea a month from every single employee on average across the organization.
We maybe need to reframe sort of ROI into return from ideas.
Yeah.
Return from investment. But it's I'm just going to bring it back there. I mean, I find the whole thing fascinating. There's a couple of things. This is in the public domain. People have known about Toyota and their process for a long time, yet other companies haven't embraced it. Why haven't they? When there's so much evidence out there, so much inspiration from whether it be sports people or business people and companies that have gone out and achieved these great things, why are companies still holding themselves back, particularly in this world where the need for creativity, the need for sort of change and innovation and reinvention is probably as more critical than it's ever been to ensure survival?
I think that the stock market has a lot to answer for. I think that when you've got shareholders involved, you've got a responsibility to your shareholders. So that if you do something that is high risk that might affect the share price, that can be seen as being illegal because you've got a responsibility to your shareholders. That's a problem. So when Nike brought out this Colin Kaepernick ad, which is wonderful, I was reading online that there was their share price went down. It plummeted after that. That people had been filming themselves burning their Nike gear. That people were...
I've probably got a few trainers that probably do need burn. I'll admit that, but yeah.
So they made a statement, and that statement has had an impact on the business. But do Nike regret it? Not one bit.
No, as Professor Galloway said this week, it's an act of genius. It's, probably the best sort of marketing sort of campaign of the last sort of decade or for this century. I mean, the media coverage they got from it that's positive is just phenomenal. I think it's an amazing sort of act of courage as well.
But for something like that to have a negative impact on the company, but for them to still see it as a success, could you imagine if you're in a Fortune 500 company and you suggest something like that? There's absolutely no way that will get through decision making, because it can have a potential kickback financially on the company like that. So,
well, I think also Professor Galloway, Scott Galloway makes the case that they've been very smart about looking at their audience, the people that will obviously react in a negative way to that use of Colin Kaepernick will be more likely to be the aging, more traditional, mm-hmm. conservative, in American context, obviously, sort of buyer. And they're probably not their future, or they're looking at more of younger, less conservative, and have a much more expansive view of the world.
People who still put ideals before a bank balance.
Exactly. So I think that's underlying it. There's probably a very sort of sound business judgment and business logic that went into it. I'm sure they wouldn't have done it without discussing that at length. And let's see where their stock price goes once their sort of sales start picking up over the next couple of months. So I think there probably has been a short-term impact on the stock market. But, yeah, let's see. Just in terms of that question of being fearless and being crazy, when you're dealing with clients, is this something you encounter, where you help them craft how they deal with fear of failure or being risk-averse?
Yeah. There's one of the things that we in the ad industry, you remember that people would always use words like brave. You need to do something brave here. Yeah. We want a brave client. No client wants to be brave. That's a ridiculous thing to ask a client to want to be. And again, I think that fearless, we don't want them to be fearless either. We want them to understand their fear and to know how to deal with it. So it's the whole thing that being fearless gets you killed. You know, it's actually having fear but doing it anyway is what keeps you alive. So it's not bad to feel fear. And I look at this, I've been running some workshops with clients over the last couple of years, which is actually helping them understand the neuroscience of decision making. And we like to think that there's just one place where our thinking happens, and it's in this meatball on the top of our head. And actually, we've got another brain. It's our somatic nervous system, which is our gut.
Yeah.
And we've got the equivalent of more than one hamster brain in here.
Yeah.
But what happens is when people feel fear, this is the bit that reacts. And people then are thinking with their hamster brain, which is just fearful. And because they see something that's different, this reacts because it goes, there's things I don't know about this. This is raising more questions. I can't be certain of the outcome. So it reacts, the gut reacts to that. Mm. Now, anything that's going to be a good idea or a good piece of innovation is unknown. It's going to raise questions. You won't know entirely how to make it happen. It may not work. And that's naturally going to happen when you're seeing something new. So what I tell people is don't react to your gut. Stop reacting to your gut. You've got to interpret your gut. So understand how your gut is reacting and then apply rational thinking to go, right, what is our gut saying then? If I'm feeling fear, is it for the right reason?
Don't you find that some of the best ideas you've encountered when working in a an agency when you see them. You just have a gut feel that they're good. Mm. Even though you can't rationalize them, you can't, there's no way you can sort of justify it or explain something that's maybe never been done before in a particular category, but you just got a gut sense that it's right.
Yeah.
And going back to that whole thing about the role of a good creative director is to be able to spot that thing that's not obvious.
Yeah.
So isn't that gut also sort of telling you at the same time? So you might be feeling the fear and the sense of concern or fear for taking a risk, but at the same time something inside you is telling you, I should do this.
Yeah, now I think that's people who know how to interpret their gut. Mm-hmm. So I think being a creative director, when you see something that's unusual, that's actually what you're looking for. So you're looking for that little bit in your stomach that might flip a little bit or something. You're looking for something that feels as if it's something you've never seen before. So that I agree that there is that kind of gut that can be good, but these are people who know how to interpret their gut. And the problem is that most people in business, they think the gut responds to patterns. It responds to unfamiliarity, and people just go, no.
And then hierarchy, again, yeah. You were talking about the managing up the way and the fear of what the next layer up is going to say kicks in. Yeah, so there's a bit of a problem there that needs to be addressed.
It's one thing that I'm feeling stronger and stronger that people need to understand judgment, and they need to understand from a physiological point of view as well. And this is something I love showing people how to judge what a great idea is. And it very often comes from the very beginning when you go, what's the problem we want to solve? Right, how will we measure a good solution? So what are the criteria that mean that we've nailed it? And when you put those criteria at the beginning, then it gives you something to aim for. And then when it comes to when you've come up with ideas, it gives you something to judge them against. And also if your idea doesn't completely meet all of those criteria, then it means that you first of all go, can we adapt it to make it meet those criteria? And if you can't, you then go, it's possibly not the right idea then. So it gives you something to measure against, and it gives you guidelines to adapt it to make it as strong as it can be. So the problem is when people don't have the criteria at the beginning, they then just rely on this vague gut at the end. So I show people how they need to actually start with the judgment framework in place so they know how to judge at the end.
You've also talked, and I can't remember, it was one of the films I've seen you do online where you talk about how to avoid killing ideas.
Yes.
As well. I mean, that's an important sort of facet of all this. Presumably, you must talk to your clients about that side of... I know it's probably more prevalent in creative agency as it's a day-to-day issue you're having to deal with, but it must affect businesses in the sort of the broader sense of creativity as well.
Yeah, for everything across the board. And I think a lot of it still is down to this judgment, you know, people just not knowing how to do it. But it's easy, and I think in that talk you saw, I was kind of... It was a slightly comedy talk about...
Yeah, I think it was it Shoreditch? Huh?
Yeah, Digital Shoreditch, yeah.
Digital Shoreditch, yeah.
And it was just pointing out all the stuff that people recognise, going, oh yeah, my company does this. So that the people came up to me afterwards and gone, oh man, you've just explained to me why I hate my job. But I try to, so these days, be a bit more positive and say actually how we can get around that. And trust is one of the important things. And... trust and care, you know, it's really simple stuff, and it sounds sort of a bit sort of Victorian values, but they're so important. And if you think about the way that a relationship between an employee and their company starts, it starts with no trust whatsoever from the company. So the contract that you sign is basically saying, if you screw up, we're going to do this to you. If you do this, we'll sue you. If you, you know, everything is all about how we do not trust you. Your contract is basically there to protect the company. Mm. And there's no flip side to the contract to say, and if we screw up, you can do this. And so that shows that we've got this imbalance, and that makes it very difficult for companies to get the trust of their employees. But the trust is vital because the employee has to trust that the company isn't going to penalize them for taking a risk, because all innovation and all new ideas have a level of risk to them. So one of the things I've been talking to companies about to get around this is the idea of seeing any budget that you're dealing with as an investment fund. Because finance guys get this. And if you were able to take... If you were fortunate enough to have 100 American dollars to invest, and you went to an investment advisor, they would say, take 80% of it and put it in to low risk, low return. It's stuff that's not going to do that much for you, but you're probably not going to lose it. And it will just, it'll be small incremental growth you're likely to get from that. Great, we'll take 20% of it and I'll put it into high risk, high return. It's the stuff that's unproven. You might risk, you might lose it, but also there's a possibility that it might go stratospheric. And that could be how you get your growth. And that's a sort of natural thing for investment people to do. So I talk to companies and say, right, take all your budgets. Look at your distribution budget. Is there something we can do here where we can take 80% of it, just do what you've always done. Low risk, low return. Just do what you've always done. We'll take 20% of it and we'll put it into stuff you've never tried before. And we're going to try stuff. And some of it might work and some of it might fail. But what it means when we have got a pot of money, it makes it easier to get people to say yes to decisions that feel as if they've got a level of risk to them. Because the money is there, it's much easier to get to it. But also, along with that, we put in a learning mechanism that's part of this innovation, so that if it works or if it doesn't work, we're going to analyze it and we're going to work out why, and we're going to work out what could we have done differently. We're going to work out what we would do next time. We're going to work out what people maybe didn't have the right skills. Do we need to add skills to this? And here's a series of questions and discussion points we'll have, and we will make sure that whether it wins or whether it loses, which is another conversation, yeah. Success, failure, win, lose, that we're going to learn from it and we're going to be stronger at the end of it. So when you build all that into an organization, that helps the organization keep moving forward. And to take those innovative, well, let's call them risks because they tend to be, take those risks that could pay off really highly for them.
I'm in the middle of listening to Ray Dalio, his book on principles. There's one phrase that struck me, which where he says, dreams plus embracing reality plus determination equals a successful life. And something sort of I thought a fair bit about. I mean, we talked obviously about the importance of dreams in relation to what Nike's recent ad. But having those sort of dreams, almost these big, sort of crazy, audacious goals and ambitions, plus the need to embrace a certain reality of where you are today, but then having the determination, the willpower, preparedness and the determination and the desire to take action and do stuff. And that's what leads to a successful life. And that what you're talking about, I feel touches on that, is the having that financial element in there that unlocks that sort of reality. It's you've got the embracing a reality of here's a budget that's there to facilitate you. Take your dreams, take your goals, and then apply them with determination. I think that is an interesting thing. I mean, I know that obviously that companies like Google and others and always had their sort of 20% rule, but it's certainly interesting.
There's a sort of similar thing from that that I've just sort of realized as you're saying there that I've been talking about is thinkers and doers and dreamers. It's kind of like different roles you can have. So a lot of business is based on doing. So people sit down at their desk and what's in front of them? They've got a computer keyboard and a monitor and they've got the mouse and they've got a desk tidy with a gonk on it saying, I gave blood. And they've got to like little stickers they took off their Apple and stuck around the monitor. And the whole thing, all of that paraphernalia, all of that furniture says that your job is to do. That your job, the way that you show your value is to hit those keys. Now, computers are not places for thinking. Computers are places for doing when you're sitting by a computer. I don't do any thinking by my computer, really. I go away, I leave my computer to think. And that means that most people are in a doing state. They're not actually thinking. They're not questioning. They're not applying their own intelligence and experience to the matter at hand. They're just doing. And there's the one thing that is really important is that people think and that they dream. And that they're given the freedom to do that. And any company that really wants to get ideas out of its staff has to understand that you need to enable people to do the thinking and the dreaming, because putting them at a desk and expecting them to sit at their desk puts them in a doing mode. And that doesn't lead to great ideas.
No, it goes back to what we were talking about over coffee yesterday, Darwin having his thinking path. And whoever you speak to that's in a creative role or has achieved great things normally talk about when the ideas come to them, or not when they're in that sort of that doing state. They're either in that alpha theta sort of a relaxed state, waking up in the morning, going to sleep at night, daydreaming, out cycling, running, wherever you are, and to get into that state where the ideas come to you. So I think it's you're just reinforcing the fact that that's it's something that organisationally businesses maybe need to sort of think about today, whether you're a small business or a large organization. It's not something that's being embraced and talked about at an institutional level.
So for you, where do the ideas come to you?
For me, it's always been, I'd say, usually waking up in the morning. It's that early state and you're coming out of the sort of the deeper sleep and you're in and out of consciousness, and that's when ideas come. And also when I'm running as well, when I can be free and not haven't got headphones on, just running, spotting things. I think you mentioned this yesterday, is having your head up and looking around and seeing things. It's where connections, it's the synapses going and this sort of the neurotransmitters sort of firing. I think it's, I think there can be the visual and there can be the oral and there can be the moment when you're in the sort of the deep sleep when ideas sort of come to you.
Yeah.
And also reading as well, reading something unexpected, something, picking up a magazine in a sort of, whether it be in a waiting room or wherever you just happen to be, and pick up a book that you've moved into, would never otherwise see, and something jumps out at you. It's one of those, coming back to the whole thing we've touched really on, the whole serendipity. It's that connection. Where does it come from? The unexpected that you cannot legislate for, it's, you cannot plan for. And it's, I think that's something that you're, what you're talking about, and the way I interpret that when you're talking to clients, is that you're trying to facilitate an environment where sort of connections or serendipity can actually sort of exist, and ideas can sort of flow.
And there's a lot of neuroscience understandings that we're getting about the way the brain works as well, how we come up with ideas. There's, you sort of mentioned waking up in the morning being a great place for ideas, maybe having a shower, sitting on an airplane, all that kind of stuff. And they discovered about 10 to 15 years ago that there is a part of the brain that activates just before you get a moment of insight. And it's about the size of your thumb, and it's above your right ear, and it's called the anterior superior temporal gyrus. And this thing, they found that there was increased blood flow to this area just before people got that moment of insight, but when they were trying to solve an insight puzzle. And that's considered to be that moment where two things come together and click. And this only switches on when you're in alpha state. It's the only time the anterior superior temporal gyrus switches on. You're in alpha state. And most people in an office environment rarely get to alpha state.
Well, because particularly when we're wired on coffee and whatever else.
But it's a stressful environment. I mean, the office is the modern prairie. It's leading to all sorts of disorders that people are having because of this high-stress environment. And giving people the opportunity to take their foot off the gas, to go into an alpha state, is how you start to get this thinking happening. And also to allow people to defocus their mind, because there's another thing we discovered in the early 2000s, is that the brain, it's got lots of areas that have got different function in it, and people have been looking for this area that creativity, what's the brain area that creativity is about? And it's not about an area. The brain goes into different network modes, and the guy who invented EEG in the early 1900s discovered that when people were focusing on a problem, there was a certain amount of energy that was being used in their brain. And then when they weren't focusing on the problem, it was still using the same amount of energy. And he was like, what's this about? And he wrote a paper about it, and he was ignored. And then in the 1960s, more studies came out, and people looked at the calorific rate that the brain was burning calories, and they discovered that it burned exactly the same amount of calories when you were focusing on a task as when you were defocused. And I was like, why is that? And again, it was ignored. And it was only in the early 2000s they sort of looked at this and realized there's the what we call the default mode network. And that's when we start to lean back and we go into a daydreamy mode. And it might be that we start replaying those conversations we've had. So, you know, when I'll be in the subway on the way back from here, I'll be going, damn it, wish I'd thought of that. And I'll be in default mode network when those thoughts come to me. Because This is when we start thinking of what-if scenarios. This is when we can look into the future and extrapolate a theory or a thought into the future and think, what would happen if we did that? What would the outcome be? And it's a really important brain state, but everything that we're about in business for the last few years has been about focus, not about defocus. Defocus is when we get the ideas. Focus is when we're productive, and everything's about productivity and about getting people to this. I just did a meeting earlier on today. They were talking about people were getting 120 to 140% utilization rate. What? That is ridiculous. So people need to be less utilized so that they can come up with ideas, because it's not just about the doing. We need to do the thinking and the dreaming as well. So that's, I probably just went off on a rant there. I apologize.
I'd like to talk a bit about your particular journey. Daniel Ek, you mentioned Spotify earlier. I mean, he's said in sort of interviews that his mother gave him the security to do what he actually wanted to do, that he felt that nothing was impossible, that you just need to go out there and do it. Again, there's a lot of just do it in today's chat. What about your individual upbringing? I mean, like myself, you're Scottish, and how did that affect you as your family, the school you went to, the environment you lived in that led you to being a creative and having this way of thinking?
Do you know, I remember as a kid that my mother had grown up two streets away from John Logie Baird. And I remember,
for those that don't know who John Logie Baird is,
John Logie Baird invented the television.
Good old Scottish inventor. Yeah.
And he, I remember going to his house, and they turned it into a museum, and it was a terrible museum. It really was. But I went there, and I remember when I started saying to my parents about, this is amazing. Television was invented in Scotland, and I remember my parents saying, lots of things were invented in Scotland. And they started to name all these things. Now, I know more about these things than they do now, but logarithms were invented in Scotland. The adhesive for the back of postage stamps. Penicillin was invented by a Scotsman. Tarmac, the steam engine. I mean, so many things were invented by Scots. We invented the world in a period of history. And I became, I guess, quite proud about that my countrymen had, because it all seemed to be men at the time in the 1800s, my countrymen had invented the world and done so many things that had such a huge impact. And I wanted a piece of that. And as a kid, I remember that being what I wanted to do, is I wanted to make a little dent in the universe in the way that some of these guys had.
So it created the sort of your belief system,
yeah,
and a confidence that you were part of a culture that you could actually sort of go out there and achieve,
yeah,
something quite astounding.
But I guess as a kid, I fell for the myth that being able to come up with stuff like that, amazing stuff, involved amazing intelligence, and it doesn't. I'm averagely intelligent. You know, I don't poke myself in the eye with a fork too often when I'm eating. But I just get really excited about my countrymen and really wanted to create stuff. And I started in my early 20s. I would come up with ideas and always coming up with little inventions and things. In my early 20s, I invented a tent peg, which I still think is awesome, that I got it patented all over the world. And then I realized that I didn't want my life to be manufacturing tent pegs. So I ended up letting it drift, and it didn't happen. And for many years,
it's not the best thing to say when you're in a sort of a bar looking to meet someone. What are you doing? Yeah, work in advertising. I'm a tent peg innovator.
Yeah. So, it wouldn't have worked. And for a long time, I was a guy who was coming up with ideas and then not seeing them through. And it probably wasn't until my early to mid-30s that I actually started to see things through by doing small projects that I could see through rather than these big things that I'd been trying to do. And then when I got the reward of being a completer, then I could start doing bigger things.
Hmm.
And you start to get into this cycle of you put in the hard work to do something, and then you get, as a little reward, you get that in the endorphins, you know, you get that little boost of yes, and that sees you through the next piece of hard work to complete something, to reach a goal, then you get an even bigger burst of endorphins. And we get this cycle, and a lot of people, they don't start on stuff because they feel they're not motivated to start on stuff. And it's not the way it works. The motivation comes after you've started. You have to get started and complete something. Mm-hmm. And then that gives you the motivation to keep going. But it's the reason why most people don't get started, because they don't understand that that cycle.
Hmm, that's fascinating. I mean, it's also something, I think, I mean, you were involved in the ad industry and in the digital and technology side, which on that digital side in the early 2000s was very much about sort of doing stuff and making stuff. So it's obviously in your character to do that. But
yeah.
Today, where technology infuses and infects everything, I mean, it's in it's probably the role of everyone in business to embrace that sort of that philosophy more and just say, just get out and do it.
Yeah.
Make something. Fail.
for most right. people in companies, there's so much fear within the layers of the companies that they don't want to do that because they feel that they will put their job at risk. And I think that the culture of a company trickles down from the top. Mm-hmm. And we've ended up with this, it almost starts at school, where there's the headmaster, then there's the teachers, then there's the prefects, and then there's the rest of the pupils. This starts with this hierarchical system, and we go into the workplace and it carries on like that, where there's the fear of the person at the top. And that is most workplaces are set up in that very destructive, poisonous way. And a lot of people who are senior, they think that their job is to lord it over other people, and they don't realize that their job is actually to be underneath them, supporting them, clearing away all the crap so that these people can be as excellent as they can be. And we need to, our organizations need to be turned upside down so that the person at the very top of the organization is actually the person with the responsibility to clear away everything for everyone else. And their attitude for caring for other people trickles down the organization, and we manage to dissolve the fear. But it's the only way to dissolve the fear.
It strikes me from just hearing you talk and having watched your videos and sort of known you for some time now, you do seem to be on a mission to create value, to help people, to help businesses navigate these difficult times. I mean, what keeps you going? What keeps you driven to do this?
I really want to make a change in the world. And there's... To me, I'm enjoying the journey rather than having necessarily a destination. I think too many people focus on the destination. I actually think that a lot of the hokey psychology stuff of if you've got to have a goal and go for that goal actually is quite disappointing for most people. And most people make the goal too big and then they never achieve it and they just end up being disappointed. I enjoy the journey. And I don't know where it's taking me, but there's certainly I've got things that I'm interested in doing. I want to change businesses at the moment, but I also am interested in a governmental level. I'd love to change a nation, and I've been talking to some governments recently. So, actually going and speaking with governments, which is great.
Got a few sort of willing, sort of open doors in this country. Your point of view.
I would love to. I wish that government.
But maybe we need to focus on Britain first. To get that sorted.
I wish that government in Britain was more welcoming.
Yeah.
And more willing to make changes, because one of the areas we need to look at is schools and education. And in the UK, they have been gradually defunding the creative subjects at school. So there's less money going into music and to art and to drama and all these things. But the problem is the people who are criticizing this are not understanding what creativity is, because those things in themselves aren't creativity. We have to split creativity into creative thinking and creative doing, so that if you want to be a great creative doer, it's going to take that mythical Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000 hours to be really good at something, so that it becomes innate and you become an expert and a master at it. But creative thinking is something we can all do, and it's fed by curiosity, and it's something that needs to be across all subjects in school, so that we actually use curiosity and discovery and all of the toolkit of the creative thinker in all of our subjects. And it's something I've been looking at how to do that over the last few years, something I would like to do, but at the moment I'm not probably quite ready to do that. I'm looking at business just now. Mm-hmm. But my dream is to change the world and to change people's lives in some way. If I can make people's lives happier, if I can make them feel more fulfilled, if I can push humanity forward through good innovation and good ideas, then I feel I've done my thing. And whether I do that through writing books or doing TV stuff or speaking or consulting with companies or working with governments, then, you know, all of these are just ways of me doing what I want to do.
Well, I think it's a great way to wrap up. I certainly think, Dave, that there are countless businesses out there that will be knocking on your door. So, I think it would be good if you could maybe share, how do people get in touch with you?
My surname is weird. If you haven't looked at the title of this podcast yet, have a look. Birss. It's a strange name, Birs. There's only 4 Dave Birses in the world, and we all got in touch with each other a few years ago.
A yearly meetup.
They're all over the world. Canada, Australia, another one in the UK, and me. But davebirs.com. All one word is the best way to get hold of me. I also hide under that pseudonym of Dave Burse as well on Twitter, on Instagram, and I love to have conversations with people. So yes, please.
Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up, Dave. I think it's a fascinating journey you've been on. I've used this quote before, and I got it from this, I think, came on Tim Ferriss' podcast, which is a Jersey Gregory. It says, hard choices, hard choices, easy life, easy choices, hard life. I think from discussing your journey, you've made some very hard choices. And so I really hope that in the future your life is going to become a lot easier by companies knocking on your door, invite you to come in and help them with their transformations, inject more creativity into them, to instill sort of belief, risk-taking attitude, to be more fearless amongst their, sort of, the organizations, because I think you've got certainly the tools, the techniques, and the experience to help them. So I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
And if anyone wants to get in touch with you, the best place to do it?
Well, probably my website, which is davebirs.com. You should probably have a look at the title of this podcast, because my surname is spelled a bit strange. And if you misspell it and you Google me, you might get not safe for work images of circumcisions, because it's the Jewish term for circumcision is if you misspell my name. So Birs is Birss. So davebirs.com. I'm also on Twitter as Dave Birs and Instagram as well. But my door is there waiting to be knocked. I'd love to hear from you.
Sounds good. Well, thanks very much.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, folks, that's it for this week. If you like the show, please subscribe, and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review, because it helps more people discover us. Just go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to subscribe and rate. For now, stay curious, be creative, and be open to serendipity. See you next time.